World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the spring and early summer of 1942, nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans were taken from their homes and put into concentration camps by the U.S. government. At the time, certainly some voices were raised against this incarceration of Americans, but generally speaking, the judiciary, the Congress, and the American people supported it. And it was quite a long time. It took quite a long time for the government in a formal way to acknowledge the fact that that had been a mistake. The executive order establishing the camps was only revoked in 1976. That was when Gerald Ford was the president. And it wasn't until 1990 that Congress formally apologized. Why did it take so long for the government to acknowledge that this had been a mistake? And what sort of lessons can we take from this chapter of American history? And those are the questions we'll take up this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is historian Roger Daniels. He has written a number of books dealing with ethnicity and immigration, and particularly with the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II. He is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Cincinnati. He is past president of the Society for Historians of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, and also the Immigration History Society. He served as consultant to the Presidential Commission on the Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. Also was planning committee member for the Immigration Museum on Ellis Island, and has authored, as I said, a number of books. One specifically that I want to mention because it deals with this subject is the book Prisoners Without Trial, Japanese Americans in World War II, and that was published in 1993. Some of his others include these books that have to do with immigration, Coming to America, A History of Immigration and Ethnicity in American Life, and Guarding the Golden Door, American Immigration Policy and Immigrants. And you can find them, I'm sure, in the library or the bookstore if you're interested in reading on the subject. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a major conference on Asian Americans in the Law, which is being sponsored by the University of Illinois College of Law. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use that number. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask it so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. It's a lovely day.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Can we just go back and talk about what people were thinking at the time? Obviously, there was a lot of fear. And the concern was, at least some people voiced, that the fear was that some Japanese Americans might work against the interest of the United States and for the interest of Japan. Was there any real, and I suppose that, you know, the question, I ask the question looking back, was there any real hard evidence that such a thing had taken place, might take place?
No, not at all. Not one single Japanese American, whether born here or an immigrant from Asia could not become naturalized citizens at that time, was even indicted for espionage, no less convicted, or sabotage. There were no such convictions. The best informed people in the government and in the security services did not recommend mass incarceration. The rationale, if you can call it that, that some military leaders, particularly General DeWitt, who was in command of the Western Defense Command, the Western States plus Alaska, said that we believe that at least 90% of them are probably loyal, But because they are, this isn't his words, but it's what he meant, because they are inscrutable Asians, we can't tell the difference. We can tell for Germans and Italians who's likely to be guilty, but we can't tell for Japanese. So we have to put them all away. The Presidential Commission, which recommended the apology and the redress payments that came, summarized its massive reports in a short statement. And in the midst of that short statement was a sentence. And that sentence was, and this is almost a direct quote, the basic causes were wartime hysteria, race prejudice, and a failure of political leadership. Wartime hysteria, race prejudice, and a failure of political leadership. I don't know any better way to describe this in a brief statement.
Was there anything like this done to Italian Americans or German Americans?
In the Western Defense Command, non-naturalized Italian Americans and German Americans were subject to certain similar but very different restrictions. These were people who could have become naturalized citizens and were not. They were required to move. Italian aliens had to leave certain professions. The most famous was Joe DiMaggio's father. For those of you who aren't old-time baseball aficionados, Joe DiMaggio was one of the two or three greatest players in the baseball, an outfielder, wonderful hitter, still has the record for consecutive games with base hits at them, 53, if I remember correctly. His father couldn't go to sea as a fisherman anymore. Some Germans, German-Americans and Italian-Americans, unnaturalized, had to move. If they had American-born children and the children wanted to stay with their parents, they had to move. But they had to move within California at a time of their own choosing, to a place of their own choosing. All Japanese-Americans living on the West Coast, and West Coast in this case meant the entire state of California, the western half of Oregon, the western half of the state of Washington, and a tiny portion, including mostly area around Boulder Dam, of Arizona. And anyone who was in those areas of Japanese birth or ancestry not only had to move, but was moved by the United States Army, most of them first to a nearby temporary camp, which was called an assembly center, and eventually were moved to one of 10 purpose-built concentration camps surrounded by barbed wire with guards, the guns pointed in, not out, where some of them stayed for more than 3 years. These were not death camps. The treatment was generally within the fact that they were being moved, was humane, but it was certainly an awful thing to do. And it was done without exception.
I know that there are some historians that have questioned your use of the term concentration camp. They have said that perhaps goes a step too far when you consider the conditions for people in the camps. Do you think that that is an important distinction, and why is it that you feel strongly that you want to use that word as opposed to a different kind of word?
Well, the word was used often during the war. Franklin Roosevelt himself in public statements called them concentration camps. They're concentration camps as opposed to internment camps, because internment is a process we've been using for enemy aliens since the War of 1812. These were selected individuals, some of them were Japanese, of foreign birth, who for some reason or other, usually guilt by association, They were put away. One group, for instance, of Japanese who were interned almost universally were Buddhist priests, whom we don't regard now as particularly dangerous, but they were partially subsidized by the Japanese government, so they were technically agents of a foreign power. Hmm. But this is done according to American law. There were proclamations issued. The Geneva Convention applied, all sorts of things. This was internment. The process was simply lawless. Roosevelt issued an order, and if you read that order, it doesn't apply to Japanese or anyone else. No one particular individual or group of individuals, ethnic or otherwise, is mentioned. If this document were found, say, in the year 3005 by some archaeologist into a perhaps vanished or greatly transformed American civilization, without supporting documents, he would have to assume that this was a relief measure to take care of certain kinds of people, because commanders are instructed to provide transportation, food, medical attention. All of that was done. But these were concentration camps. The word in this sense came into the English language only in the Spanish, in the Boer War, where the British did this to Boers in South Africa, Dutch-speaking individuals who were opposed to British imperialism. So concentration camps, I think, is correct. A number of people object to it, not very many historians. Many victims of the Holocaust have said, you know, that's our word. Well, these were not death camps. Many, many more people were born in them than died in them. There was every attempt to provide humane treatment. There were schools, etc. But no system of law governed who got in or who got out. It was simply what the government administrators decided. No court was willing to do anything until 1944 in December, when in the third of the three Japanese-American cases, the first two said in effect, it's all right to put people in concentration camps. But a young woman named Mitsui Endo and her attorneys filed for habeas corpus. They filed in 1942. It got to the Supreme Court in December 1944. And the court said, oh, she's a loyal American against whom there are no charges. She ought to be free to come and go as she chooses. And the Army had been releasing people, but it had been releasing people to resettle anywhere but on the West Coast. West Coast was home to her. What the court said was that was no longer legal.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. For other people who are listening, I think I should introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Roger Daniels. He is Charles Phelps Taft Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Cincinnati and has written widely on issues of ethnicity, immigration, and also about the experience of Japanese Americans during World War II. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a conference dealing with issues of Asian Americans and the law, sponsored by the U of I College of Law. And we're pleased to have him here with us on the program as well. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Philo, line number one.
Thank you.
Yes?
Japanese brought the war on itself and had won all of the British colonies in the Asian Pacific area in the 10 years during which they did that without ending the war with China prior to Pearl Harbor. The Second World War was a classical tragedy that the Japanese brought on themselves by the naked aggression that they met with an irresistible force by the Americans. The Japanese knocked out the American battle fleet on December the 7th, 1941, at Pearl Harbor.
And your point is, sir?
My point is, That was without any aggression by the United States at that time. And then the Americans got together in general and started retaliating against the Japanese.
Well, pardon me, sir, I don't presume to speak for our guests, but it seems to me that the people here we're talking about, the people who were put in these camps, they weren't Japanese, they were Americans. It seems to me that's the central issue.
Okay, then, if they were Americans, how could those folks be identified as true Americans when the population of the United States was defending themselves and didn't have time to take all of those people to court to determine who was loyal and who wasn't? I mean, you had Tokyo Rose that's going on at that time, and every day, several hours in the day, she was proclaiming the horrendous, terrible situation that the Americans were fighting.
Well, let me give again the guest a chance to respond, because that was a point that people at the time raised, as you said. How do we determine whether, in fact, some Japanese Americans might be working against the United States?
Were you in the armed forces then?
I'm a decorated veteran of two wars. Which has absolutely nothing to do with the question. By the way, and in the American Army, the fact of the matter is that, of course, we were at war with three nations, primarily: Japan, who attacked us; Germany, who declared war shortly thereafter; and Italy, who declared war shortly thereafter. All in the second week of December, 1941. We did not treat Germans in the United States, and I'm not suggesting that we should have, as if they had to prove their loyalty. In the United States, sir, persons are assumed innocent until proven guilty. Japanese Americans, whether born here or persons who had lived here, and all of these persons, since we stopped immigration from Japan in 1924, had been living here and leading generally exemplary lives for at least 17 years. They were guilty simply by reason of their genes, of their genetic ancestry. There's no place for that in the Constitution. There's no place for that in American law. And the United States Congress, both houses, recognized this in 1988. Three presidents, Ronald Reagan, the first George Bush, and Bill Clinton, signed letters of apology. Reagan did not sign a letter of apology because there was no money yet, and the letter went along with that, but he made a statement. Signed letters of apology while the survivors of this were paid $20,000. That's the only formal apology to a group the United States has ever made. This was absolutely wrong. Almost everyone recognizes this. This has nothing to do with the war against Japan. The war against Japan was a just war, a war the United States eventually won at great cost. But these people, living mostly in California, had nothing to do with that, had committed no crimes, and, that's enough, I think.
I do have some other callers here, and I want to just make sure that if the caller would like to make a quick follow-up, I'll give him the opportunity to do that.
Please, quick follow-up.
Yes.
Blood is thicker than water. I went in on the invasion of Saipan June the 15th, 1944, with the 4th Marines, and I caught hell. I was in the first wave going in. On July the 24th, landed on White Beach 1 in Tinian, a shipwrecked on that island, with more than 9,000 fanatical Japanese waiting for us on Tinian, and that was terrible.
Are you aware that thousands of Japanese Americans participated in both?
Oh, sure. We had a lot of Nisei's that were great, but how are you going to separate friends from enemy when a instantaneous situation occurs where they're battling each other?
Well, no Japanese American was doing anything to harm the United States.
Oh, you knew all the Japanese Americans, so you knew that didn't happen. Tokyo Rose just incessantly told us about the tragedies that they were inflicting on the Americans.
And what happened to Tokyo Rose was later, rightly or wrongly, indicted and convicted in an American court. She was someone who was trapped in Japan. That's quite correct. Whether she was guilty or not, she was tried and found guilty. We didn't try Japanese Americans. We said they were guilty by reason of their race, really ethnicity. And it has nothing to do with that. There were people drafted out of concentration camps who went into the 42nd and other units, or military intelligence specialists, Japanese Americans, who performed ably. Not one Japanese American in the United States was even indicted for anything like sabotage or espionage. I'm sure you had a rough time. I think anybody who was in any war has, to greater or lesser degree, a rough time. You and I both survived. Lots of our friends did not. But that has nothing to do with the guilt or innocence of people here in the United States who had done nothing.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have some others who are waiting and like to go on. We'll go next to someone here in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Downey, California, and was a high school student there. And many of my friends were scooped up and sent off to concentration camps. They were very active in our student body, and I had lunch with a number of them every noon. Now, it's interesting that I went back to Downey, California High School this last June because there were some recognition programs. This is 60 years after graduation. And I got a letter shortly thereafter that at the graduation this last June in Downey, they recognized many of these Nisei students who never were graduated. And seven of them were present for the graduation in June. They were given full recognition and their diplomas. There were another 17 that they tried to contact and bring back for their graduation. Now, I thought that was an interesting conclusion of their high school experience, but another picture of the guilt that many of us felt about all of this. Some of my friends did fight with that army unit in Italy and performed marvelously. And they were great kids, and we had a panic. I remember those signs on telephone posts by General DeWitt saying that this had to happen. But they lost their property. There was a truck garden 100 yards from our home. They lost that property that would have been worth millions now, but they lost the whole ball of wax. I wonder if we're not treating Middle Easterners now with the same attitude. But I thank you for your program, and I say blessings on them all. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks for the call. You want to comment on any of that?
Well, there have been a number of such ceremonies at colleges, at universities. Each of the three West Coast states has made certain restitution to public employees who were denied. This is one of those things that we as a nation, did and eventually realized that it was wrong and eventually did something about it. Although the situation with persons after 9/11 is nothing like the same, it's quite clear that there have been excesses, although mostly directed against foreign-born persons. And it would not surprise me if 15, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, there will be certain kinds of revisionist notions from government officials about what was done now. But I think it was in no wise comparable, simply because, with the exception of a couple of people who were just technically United States citizens and had never really lived here, the persons affected have not been American citizens or in many cases even longtime American residents. That doesn't mean that what was done to them was right, because some of them were quite clearly picked up because they looked like they were Middle Eastern. Some of them were not. The first revenge killing, supposedly for for 9/11 was a Sikh who some misguided person in the Southwest thought was Middle Eastern because he wore a turban. Amen.
We have other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. This is very enlightening for me. I'm a student, a college student, and I've never heard anything about all of this having happened, even though I've studied American history. And my question is very similar to the gentleman, the second caller. And I was wondering, in the post 9/11 makeup of our society, how possible do you think it is that something like this could happen again? You know, if we face another attack, do you think we could return to the same kind of hysteria?
I think that if it were bad enough, it could happen. It would probably happen under somewhat different circumstances. We have certainly given the government much more direct enforcement powers under the Patriot Act and certain other things, but that's hypothetical. It should be pointed out that everybody just talks about Pearl Harbor. But Pearl Harbor happened on December 7th, 1941. Executive Order 9066 was issued on February 19th, 1942, some 74 days later. And during that time, there were just an absolute chain of disasters, not on American soil, although a Japanese submarine did pop up and shoot 3 shells at some oil tanks at off Santa Barbara and missing them all. But in Southeast Asia, the Japanese government, the Japanese forces were running wild. If we'd had a whole series of attacks, God forbid, following 9/11, I think that the reactions would certainly have been much, much harsher. And there are clearly people in our security establishments who would have said that the reason these later events happened was that we hadn't been harsh enough in our reactions after 9/11. But that's all hypothesis.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Call. I wonder if I might ask you to pick up on another point that the caller made. And it's something else that people have noted as well, that this chapter of American history seems to have been left out of a lot of books, and there are a lot of people who would say, well, gee, I studied American history, and I don't understand how anyone could say they had never heard that this had happened, but I'm sure that there are people who would say, this comes as news to me.
For years afterwards, there was almost nothing in American textbooks. A line that didn't make it at all clear. In one textbook that I always talk about, there's a sentence in a paragraph about the Second World War, and this was written by a group of distinguished American historians, the most prominent of whom was Richard Hofstadter. This was a very liberal text. But the only thing they said about Japanese Americans during the Second World War was that under a section that was headed civilian mobilization. And it started out by congratulating the United States for its better protection of the civil liberties of German Americans in World War II than had taken place in World War I, and that's true. And then as sort of an afterthought, it said, some people thought that what was done to Japanese Americans, and it didn't say Japanese Americans, I forget the exact phrases, was unfair or worse, but never really made the point of just what was done to them, and that's all that was talked about. I know of no college textbook today that doesn't at least mention this. And a friend of mine who teaches in Minnesota wrote me recently that he's been asking this question for years. But when he asked his class this year, his freshman class this year, how many of them had heard of the Japanese of what happened to Japanese Americans in World War II, more than half had heard about it, and some of them could even describe it in some detail. These were people who were just starting college. So it's better than it was. I don't think it gets as much attention as it should, but almost every specialist feels that what he specializes in doesn't get enough attention. Yeah. But it's a good point.
A little bit past the midpoint here, I have some other callers we will get to. In just a moment, I do want to introduce again our guest. Roger Daniels is Charles Phelps Taft Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Cincinnati and has written widely on issues of ethnicity and immigration and also on the Japanese-American experience in World War II. One book, if you're interested in reading on the subject, you might look at is his book Prisoners Without Trial, Japanese-Americans in World War II. He is here visiting the campus, taking part in a conference on Asian-Americans and the law that is sponsored by the University of Illinois College of Law. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller is here in Urbana, and that would be line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Well, first of all, I wanted to mention, I was in my senior year of high school in 1975 in Ohio, and we saw a very moving documentary about this in my history class, but maybe that wasn't the rule. The main thing I wanted to say, the caller a couple of calls back who had served in the Pacific Theater during World War II and talked about his terrible experiences there, which, of course, were terrible but weren't the fault of Japanese-Americans, brought up the question of, you know, well, said, you know, I guess one of the arguments I've heard people say before about, like, you know, why they were against having Japanese-Americans serve as soldiers, because how do you tell, like, who's your friend or who's your enemy? But I've never, ever, ever heard anyone use that argument as a case for why, you know, white Anglo-Saxon soldiers shouldn't be sent to Europe. And so I find that kind of curious that as an argument. I mean, it just doesn't seem like a reasonable argument just on that basis alone, because most of the soldiers that went over to Europe would have looked just like the people that they were shooting and being shot by. So I've always wondered about that argument. So anyway, I appreciate your program here and what you're saying, and thank you.
All right. You want to comment on that at all?
No, I think it's a very good point. Certain people, more and more, we don't scholars at least don't think of the term white as really meaning very much, and it certainly covers a vast variety of shades, and it's been all sorts of ways different, but an unstated, inarticulate major premise in most of what most Americans say about these things is an assumption that if you're white, you're all right. If you're other than white, and there was a time when if you're other than white Protestant, then you're expected to behave a certain way, and everyone else is what Kipling called the lesser breeds without the law. But I think the caller makes a very, very good point that isn't made enough and that I wish the first caller would think about.
All right, let's talk with someone in Danville there next, line one.
Hello. Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking the call. The first caller really kind of triggered a question that I have. I've noticed over the last several years, especially among World War II vets, this they don't seem to recognize the police state that is beginning to evolve in this country. In fact, I've even talked to World War II vets that, you know, as far as they're concerned, police should be able to walk into your house anytime. And I really find, you know, I couldn't understand, you know, if anyone who would be very sensitive to a police state, you would think it would be those people who fought, you know, so valiantly for our freedoms. And I'm wondering if what happened, and you know, the first caller really talked about the fact that these people were, you know, associated with a regime that was, you know, had attacked us. And I just wonder if part of that attitude today does not stem from that.
Well, it's a complicated thing. Let me broach into what may seem to be a side issue, but I think really illuminates some of this very nicely. One of the divisions within the Japanese-American community is the divisions among the Japanese-American veterans of World War II over how they should treat a small minority of Japanese Americans who, while in concentration camps, resisted the draft on the principle that since we are deprived of our rights, we do not have to follow the duties. If you want to release us and our parents from these camps, we will serve. Otherwise, we will resist. And the largest group of draft resistors in American history were tried in Cheyenne, Wyoming in 1945 and convicted in a trial that was a farce because they were clearly guilty. They had resisted the draft. And among Japanese-American veterans, there's been a real division over this. Some Japanese-American veterans sound about this issue, not about the concentration camps issue, but about this issue, the way the first gentleman this morning spoke about Japanese-Americans in general. Other Japanese-American veterans have a different view, and more have come to that review. There's been that view. There's been some reconciliation to what are called the Japanese-American war resistors, a very tiny minority. That takes a lot of guts. And most veterans. But there are still some who really have very little to do with them. And there are plenty of World War II veterans. I was in a merchant marine in the Second World War myself. There are many veterans who feel exactly this way. The other thing is that many people who principally identify themselves as veterans are more likely to have what some call militaristic views than others who regard their time in the military as a necessary but really unpleasant part of their lives that they really want to have very little to think about. They did their duty and they went home and left. Others glory in that and view it as the high point of their lives without in any way impugning anyone's patriotism, loyalty, and bravery. It seems to me that if the high point of your life is something you did as a very, very young person and involved killing other people, you've had a fairly empty life.
Well, I wonder also if the same issue has not also allowed this current administration to basically ignore the Geneva Conventions and, you know, do the things that they're doing towards torture and the other internment of the Middle Eastern people that we see happening. And I'll listen offline.
Further thoughts?
I think that all kinds of people, there's been military lawyers, for instance, lawyers in the Army have been very much concerned over this Geneva Convention thing, as are many regular military officers, simply because they know well that sooner or later we're going to have persons taken prisoner, and they very, very much want the Geneva Convention to apply. The State Department during the Second World War, for instance, was very concerned that Japanese Americans and in turn Japanese nationals be treated properly, simply because they knew that there were large numbers of Americans in Japanese hands, in the hands of the Japanese government, who wanted to be treated. So it's a kind of mixed bag. There are plenty of people in the military who don't approve of this. It was mostly civilian lawyers who dreamed up these things, not military lawyers. Military lawyers have been long trained under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to live with the Geneva Convention and to understand it and to teach about it. In my military service in the Korean War, because our unit was in part involved with building the prisoner camps up on the 42nd parallel near Panmunjom, I had to take special classes in the Geneva Convention so that we didn't do anything like point a gun at a prisoner, which was not to be permitted at any distance, simply because you didn't do that unless there was an emergency.
Let's talk with someone else. Let's go to Homer for our next caller. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a 78-year-old veteran of World War II, and I'm hearing all these things, but in retrospect, it's easy to wring our hands and so forth. But at that time, the internment is probably a minor thing when you stop to think about what has happened. It's no secret that the Japanese and the Germans as well were not particularly kind to any group that they thought was different. And I wonder what would be the situation now if we were either speaking German or Japanese on this program as a result of what had happened. The other thing I wonder about is that were there any evidence that anybody in, say, even Hawaii or any of the other islands were, in fact, involved with this sort of thing? And so that brings up the question again of how do you determine who's on your side and who's not? And it's pretty easy to determine that people are Japanese, so it makes it much easier to do with that. The third thing is, this was not a contest. This was not a debate. This was not a sporting contest where the winner went away. This is a kill or be killed situation. And the rules, if you want to call it that, didn't necessarily apply when you stop to think about the number of civilians that were killed on all sides. I wonder if there are comments on those.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the real military leaders of the United States, General Marshall, Admiral King, and others, thought that this was useless, that thought it was a detriment to the war effort. Military manpower, all sorts of materiel was used to create these 10 concentration camps with all their equipment. Some of the food was a weapon during the Second World War. Some of the most productive farmers in the United States were taken off their farms. It was counterproductive when politicians tried to impose the same kind of regulations on the Japanese Americans living in Hawaii, where every third person was Japanese, where Japanese were an important part of the war effort, where in the dark days immediately after Pearl Harbor, National Guard groups and even high school, college and high school ROTC units, largely of Japanese Americans, who were every third person in the island, were given guns and put into trenches to defend against an attack that never came. Nobody was concerned that they had Japanese faces. They were treated as Americans, and they behaved as Americans. There were no convictions, no indictments of any individual of Japanese ancestry, or regardless of where they were born in the United States during the entire war. In other words, there was no evidence against anyone. No overt acts. There were certainly people, like the Attorney General of California, Earl Warren, who argued that this fact, that there had been no sabotage, was the most ominous thing of all, because that meant that there was some kind of plan to prevent sabotage or to withhold sabotage until everyone's guard was down. Now, that's a wonderful catch-22. If there had been sabotage, Warren would have said, see, here's a case of sabotage. If that fellow's guilty, there must be lots of others. But they didn't have one single case. So they said, well, there's an invisible deadline. How can you argue against a thing like that? It's nonsense. Our society is based on law. Law requires that guilt be individual, not collective. We ignored that to our detriment in World War II in terms of Japanese Americans. The whole Congress, the whole United States government now recognizes that this was a fact. And there are, I'm a 77-year-old. I was a merchant marine in the Second World War. little underage, and fought in the Korean War. So I'm almost as old as you are. I was horrified when I got back from a trip in 1945 and met someone in New York City, an American citizen who had been in a camp and had only recently been released. Because what I thought I was fighting for were American principles. And that, it seemed to me at the time, and it seems to me now, was essentially the most un-American kind of activity, to incarcerate persons not because of their personal guilt, but because of who their ancestors were and what kind of genes they had. And if we as a nation continue to do something like this, we won't be worth fighting for, in my notion. But we haven't done that. This was an aberration. We're not doing that now. There's been a lot of hysteria, but nothing comparable to this has happened, and I hope nothing comparable to this ever happens again. But certainly it could. Anything that has happened in history can clearly be repeated, although history never fully repeats itself. I've gone on too long.
We have about 3-4 minutes left. One more caller I want to make sure we include. This is someone listening in Lafayette, Indiana, and our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Don, and I lived in the Lompoc Valley in the 1950s and worked there. And I learned from the locals that there was a young man of Japanese descent who flew over the Pacific coast in that area, taking photographs and sending them to the Japanese for shelling the West Coast. And after the war, Japanese were not welcome back into the Lompoc Valley. In fact, when they came back, they were shunned in Lompoc, but they went to the valley just north of there, the Santa Maria Valley, where I saw my first Japanese bobby sockers, by the way. But anyhow, that has been my experience in the thing. And that fellow did graduate from the Lompoc High School, and they just felt devastated that one of their own would be spying for the Japanese.
You don't know this. You just heard this. Do you know the person's name?
Well, they're all dead.
Well, it's, you know, it's a nice story, but...
Well, you could check it out if you want to go to Lompoc, L-O-M-P-O-C.
I know exactly where it is.
Okay.
And I know that that was an area where there had been much Japanese leaseholding. And after the Japanese left, many people got those leases and didn't want the Japanese to come back. Whether this was a story concocted to justify their exclusion of Japanese from what had been not land that they owned, because there was an Alien Land Act, but these people certainly didn't want the Japanese to come back. But whether it was because of this mythical spotting of aircraft, or whether it was a sense of guilt over what they'd done, I haven't got the foggiest idea. And I don't believe you really know either, because what you're talking about is hearsay.
No, this is correct, but I thought you might want to know this, because if you want to, you could check out the Lompoc High School yearbook and find out more about it. And as I said, they were not welcome into that valley. The working people in that valley after the war, who were welcomed more, were the Filipinos who were not involved to any extent during the war.
They were agricultural laborers who picked the crops,
but who didn't
own the land.
Mexicans and Filipinos were the major laborers when I was there.
All right. Well, again, I thank you for the call. We're just about at the point where we're going to have to stop. The order that created these camps, this was signed in 1942. It was not until 1976 that it was officially revoked. That was Gerald Ford. And
That's right.
Wasn't until 1990 that there was the formal apology.
88.
In 88. I guess the question I'm left with is, why did it take so long?
That's a good question. There were some ameliorative measures taken fairly soon thereafter. President Truman, for instance, in 1946, when some Japanese American units came home, some of them, he reviewed them behind in the ellipse behind the White House, gave them another Distinguished Units decoration, and said, not quite correctly, but his heart was in it, "You have fought against prejudice and you have won." In 48, there was a little property compensation, not much. In 1952, we revoked or changed the law so that Japanese Americans and other Asians could be naturalized, so that there were a number of ameliorative measures. But this took a lot of doing. This is the only formal apology the United States Congress has ever made for this kind of a group action. It was an unprecedented event. And if someone had told me that it was going to happen, oh, as early as the mid-60s, I would have said, you're crazy, that can't happen. Hmm. But it did happen.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Our guest, Roger Daniels, Charles Phelps Taft, Professor Emeritus of History at University of Cincinnati. If you're interested in reading on the subject, one book you might look at is his book, Prisoners Without Trial, Japanese Americans in World War II. Thank you very much. Programming here on WILL made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The broadcast is also made possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, presenting Origins of a Networked World from World War II to the Internet, Thursday, February 17th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. We're going to take a break, as we usually do. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. Well, there's a lot of red on the screen this morning. We're also seeing that new contract lows coming in the corn market again today, as that March contract down 3/4 at the moment, 194.5 has been